Section 3. Answering questions and anticipating problems. My colleagues and I receive plenty of good questions all the time from clients, consultants, executives, and managers, and we've had to address various objections and obstacles with our clients before and during team-building sessions. So I thought, hey, let's put all that stuff in the book, too. Common questions. How long does it take to build a team? Our research indicates that in North America it takes 39 days. In Europe and Asia, 38. I'm kidding. It's impossible to answer this question for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is, does a team ever really complete the process? It's more of an ongoing process, like a marriage. Another reason why it's tough to answer is that so many factors influence a team's progress. I'll list them here in the form of questions, like Jeopardy. How much time has been set aside for team building? How committed are the members to becoming a team? How many members are there? Are they all located in the same city or office? How much history does the group already have? Is that history positive or negative? How strong and credible is the leader? Okay, now that I've sufficiently qualified my answer, let me say that if I were forced to provide a concrete time frame, on average, I would say that a new team can make substantial progress in 2 or 3 months. That assumes that the team members have 1 or 2 off-site meetings during that span and that they regularly spend time together during meetings and various working sessions. Having said all that, a team can actually make dramatic progress in far less time, even a few days. How many people should be on a team? This is the $64,000 question for sure. And while there is no way to answer it definitively for every organization, I believe the range is from 3 to 12. Most organizations I work with err on the side of including too many people on a team, in many cases because they don't want to exclude anyone. It's as though they're mistakenly viewing team membership as a reward or a benefit, rather than as a strategic decision about how to best run the organization. And while I salute the desire to be inclusive, there are some big problems with having too many people on a team. On a purely practical and tactical note, it's tough to coordinate meetings and other team activities when there are 15 schedules to consider. More important, it's difficult for team members to get to know one another, develop bonds of trust with one another, when there are too many people in the room. Generally speaking, a kid who grows up in a family of 10 children is probably not going to have as deep and meaningful relationship with most siblings as a kid born to a family of 4. Generally speaking, that is. But perhaps most important of all, having too many people on a team makes team dynamics during meetings and other decision-making events almost impossible. That's because a good team has to engage in 2 types of communication in order to optimize decision-making. But only one of these is practical in a large group. According to Harvard's Chris Argyris, those 2 types of communication are advocacy and inquiry. Basically, advocacy is the statement of ideas and opinions. Inquiry is the asking of questions for clarity and understanding. When a group gets too large, people realize they are not going to get the floor back anytime soon, so they resort almost exclusively to advocacy. It becomes like Congress, which is not designed to be a team, or the United Nations. Ditto. One member says, "I think we should pursue Proposal A," provoking another member to say, "Well, I think we should pursue Proposal B." Someone else lobbies for C, yet another person wants A with a slight modification, and before you know it, everyone is trying to get their opinion heard. Inquiry, on the other hand, would entail one of the members saying, "Wait a minute, I'd like to hear you explain why you support Proposal A, because I want to understand your rationale. After all, if it makes sense, I could go along with it." Okay, that might be just a little too idealistic, but you get the point. How likely is it that you'll have to remove a member of the team in order to make progress? This is a tough question, but an important one. First, let me be clear. Getting rid of someone on the team is not a standard part of our team-building process. Ironically, however, being willing to lose a team member will greatly decrease the likelihood that you'll have to do so. How can that be? Because if everyone on the team knows that the leader is willing to remove someone if doing so is in the best collective interest of the group, then they will be far more likely to consider behavioral change. This in turn increases the likelihood that no one will actually need to be removed. On the other hand, if everyone knows that the leader is unwilling to even consider swapping out a difficult team member, they'll be more likely to dig in their heels and resist change. It actually makes sense, doesn't it? Now, I'd be naive if I didn't admit that there are times when one member of a team, or more, needs to be replaced in order for the team to gel. It shows up in sports, business, classrooms, and every other team dynamic. However, I would say that most of the teams we work with don't find it necessary to replace a member during the 6 months after embarking on a team improvement process. I'd also say that many of them do after a period of 6 months to a year as the team evolves and grows, sometimes beyond the interest or capability of a given member. How much can be accomplished during a 2-day off-site session? Short answer, a lot. I've seen new teams establish non-trivial bonds that last for years in just one session. And I've seen dysfunctional teams address painful issues that have plagued them for years over the course of a day and a half. But here's the thing. That kind of progress is often a little painful and exhausting. It requires good old-fashioned hard work. Remember, good team-building off-sites are not boondoggles, excuses for golfing and massages. And they're not about catching each other falling off a chair or climbing a tree. They're intense, focused, and grounded in operational issues, not touchy-feely ones. If a team goes away for a 2-day off-site and spends 6 hours riding bicycles and playing bocce ball, its members aren't going to get 2 full days of benefit out of the experience. If I'm a manager of the team, should I use an outside consultant or facilitator? The key to this question is whether you can find a really good consultant or facilitator. If not, then go it alone. If you know of someone who is practical, trustworthy, and skillful, then it might be a good idea to bring them in. The benefit of having an outsider help you is that you can take part in the process as a member of the team, which you are, rather than having to also play the role of facilitator. Now, some managers and executives are quite good at this. Others are not. So, like so many other things in life, it really depends. For those who are reluctant to spend money on an outsider, it's important to consider the hidden but staggering costs associated with being a dysfunctional team. The cost of losing and having to replace one good team member will more than cover any initial expense for a good consultant. And that's before factoring in the value of higher productivity and reduced stress. Objections from participants. We can't take 2 whole days out of the office. The most precious commodity for any team, executive or otherwise, is time, not money. And so the most common and, frankly, most effective objection that we hear from leaders and team members is, there is no way we can afford to spend 2 full days out of the office. Of course, this is either a miscalculation of the cost-benefit relationship associated with teamwork, or, just as likely, a body-blow attempt to prevent a team-building initiative from getting started at all. Whether you're a leader or a consultant, be prepared for this objection, and if at all possible, eliminate it by beating the proponent to the punch. Explain up front, before the initiative begins, how much time is already being wasted because of politics, confusion, internal competition, and revisiting issues over and over again. Sell the program like you would any other product or service, by illustrating the problems that exist and proposing a practical solution. Take the "we don't have time" issue off the table before anyone can raise it. But we have real work to do. This is a continuation of the first objection, but with a different spin. Again, you want to respond to this one with confidence. Building a team is real work because it is all about getting more work done in less time. If people want to measure productivity in terms of 48-hour increments, then I suppose that leaving the office for 2 days might set a team back a few hours in terms of time away from email and voicemail and whatever individual contributor jobs people have. But when measured in a more reasonable time frame, a year, 6 months, 3 months, heck, even 2 weeks, the productivity achieved by focusing on working as a team easily outweighs a day or two away from the office. Adrenaline addiction. All of this highlights one of the most challenging obstacles that prevents teams from taking the time to work on how they work together. Adrenaline addiction. Many, if not most, of the executives and managers I know have become so hooked on the rush of urgent demands and out-of-control schedules that the prospect of slowing down to review, think, talk, and develop themselves is too anxiety-inducing to consider. Of course, this is exactly what they need, which is what addiction is all about. Doing things that are bad for you even when confronted with evidence that they are, well, bad for you. One suggestion, call it what it is. Confront people with the idea that they may be victims of an adrenaline addiction. There is something about describing it that way that makes people sit back and listen, at least for a few minutes, until the need for a rush hits them again. But maybe those few minutes are what you need to get them to commit to building the team. These touchy-feely sessions are nonsense. The best way to deal with this objection is to agree. Because I certainly do. Touchy-feely sessions are nonsense. But that is not what this book and the programs we're describing are all about. They're about getting more done in less time. They're about making better decisions faster. They're about keeping your best performers and possibly helping the poorer ones to improve or find another place to work. And they're about achieving results. There is nothing touchy-feely about this. Just because some consultants and authors have taken a touchy-feely, new-age approach to team building doesn't mean that what you're proposing isn't practical. Because it has to be practical. As the leader or facilitator, it is your responsibility to ensure that you are grounding the team-building process within the practical and tactical realities of the business of the team. And it is your responsibility to handle, even welcome, these kinds of objections as an opportunity to establish the practical tone of your team-building effort. So the best way to deal with this concern is to address it head-on. I hate touchy-feely sessions, too, and that's why this isn't going to be one of those. We aren't going to be catching one another falling off a chair, and we're not going to be getting naked, holding hands, or singing songs. This is just another flavor of the month. Next quarter, we'll be on to something new. The key to answering this objection is to prove it false. The leader of a team, more than the facilitator, must make it clear to the team that this is not going to go away, that there is nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. And, of course, then the leader must not allow anyone to run away and hide. Even if the fear of losing momentum coming out of the offsite isn't enough to scare a leader, the prospect of losing credibility should be. So, as I asked at the beginning of this book, before embarking on this process, leaders must ask themselves if they're willing and able to follow through. Obstacles to avoid. The leader isn't truly committed to building a team. This is another tough one. The fact is, leadership matters. If the leader of a team doesn't understand the power of teamwork and isn't prepared to lead the effort in terms of setting an example and dedicating time to it, then the chances of success are basically zero. However, many leaders who might seem uninterested in teamwork are often just skeptical about the possibility of achieving it, or are afraid that acknowledging the need for it might reflect poorly on them. In these cases, success is possible as long as they're willing to start the process with good intentions. We've worked with many skeptical, not cynical, but skeptical leaders who have changed their attitude about building their team after just a few hours. When they realize that building a team is not a touchy-feely group grope, but rather an attempt to improve the business, they begin to warm up to the idea. And when they discover that their staff members really do want to work hard and that they're actually rooting for the leader to succeed, the sky's the limit. Well, that might be a bit of an overstatement, but I got caught up in the moment. One way to help leaders overcome their initial doubts and understand the real nature of team building is to let them read the Five Dysfunctions book. I realize that this might sound self-serving, and I suppose it is. But the power of the story is that it allows readers to detach from the lessons by getting caught up in the characters. Before they know what's hit them, they're thinking about themselves and how they can accomplish what Catherine, the main character in the book, has accomplished. If this doesn't work, you might want to consider anonymously sending a copy of the book to your leader every day for a year. Just a thought. Team members are holding back. Sometimes people decide not to oppose a team-building effort actively, but rather to sit back and derail the effort passively. And to be fair, sometimes people do this without malice, just because they're uncomfortable. In any case, know that this is not only an easily addressed issue, it is a hidden opportunity for a radical conversion. But the only way that I found to win converts among the skeptics is to face them head on. That's right. As initially awkward as it is to confront someone, "Fred, it seems like you're not engaging here. Are you uncomfortable with what we're doing? Or is there another issue you want to help us understand?" It is often the most effective way to diffuse tension in the room and move the team forward. And think about it this way. When a difficult team member decides to hold back and passively resist the team-building effort, the goal is to make others in the room uncomfortable enough to back off. That is victory for the resistant member when the leader blinks. It's like a game of chicken, and your opponent wants you to bail out first. So I guess the lesson here is this. Team leaders or consultants can only overcome resistance among team members by overcoming their own resistance or fear of discomfort first. someone is dominating the session. Instead of holding back, sometimes team members can do the opposite. They dominate the conversation. Dealing with this is a little trickier than it might seem, but nonetheless it is doable. First, understanding the motivation for dominating is key. Is the person just a naturally talkative, conversation-dominating kind of person? If so, then the team is probably used to it, which calls on the team leader or consultant to take an appropriately gentle approach. And this is another area where the Myers-Briggs or some other profiling tool can come in handy. Okay, Fred, as an extrovert, you're comfortable speaking up quickly and thinking out loud, which is fine, but we need you to help draw out the others on the team who might not be as open with their ideas. Whatever. In most of these situations, well-intentioned team members will quickly and gladly edit their behavior. Of course, 15 minutes later, they'll need to be gently reminded again, but they'll be okay with that. But if the dominating person has another agenda, perhaps one driven by insecurity or the need to manipulate the session, a more direct approach may be necessary. Now, I'm not talking about a serial killer here, or even a psychologically unbalanced team member. I'm thinking more along the lines of a person who really doesn't want to be vulnerable and who tries to control the dynamics in the room to avoid it. Thankfully, the exercises outlined in this book often provide exactly the right kind of opportunity to help that person get comfortable. But from time to time, a facilitator will have to confront people to help them admit what their concerns are. This might need to happen during a break, one-on-one, if the situation seems particularly difficult. And ultimately, if the exercises and gentle prodding of the facilitator don't bring about the desired improvement, it might be time to start thinking about whether that person is capable of being a productive member of the team. But that's only for when the other methods have truly been exhausted. Team members are geographically dispersed and don't spend much time together. There should be no doubt about the fact that having all members of a team in one location is a distinct advantage. People must spend time together to develop trust, learn to engage in conflict, and do all of the other things that are signs of real teamwork. Physical separation makes that difficult, but not impossible. Many teams must rely on phones, video conferencing, and other forms of technology to interact, and some of these methods are remarkably effective. However, for some activities, there is simply no substitute for face-to-face interaction. What kind of activities am I referring to? Team-building activity, for one, and major discussions of strategy. No matter how advanced video conferencing becomes, and it has a long way to go, it is just not realistic to expect people to be emotionally vulnerable, provide constructive feedback, and hold one another accountable for their behaviors over a T1 line. There is something uniquely powerful about being in a room together and being able to read the body language, facial expressions, and other subtle behavioral cues. All of this means that people must commit to getting together on a regular basis, monthly, maybe quarterly, and using that time effectively if they are going to become a team. Unfortunately, too many teams use their scarce time together primarily for social activities. And while there is certainly a place and a need for social interaction among team members, it should not occur at the expense of substantive team building and problem solving. A top performer isn't interested in or committed to the team building process. This is a classic challenge for teams and their leaders, and a difficult one. But the answer is clear. Great teams are made up of great team members. And as painful as it is in the short term, and it is certainly painful, A team is better off removing a talented but disruptive team member for the long-term good of the team. Professional sports are littered with examples of teams that lose their star player only to improve their team performance the next year and beyond. Of course, this is easier said than done, especially when you're staring at a monthly report and your disruptive team member is at the top of the list and bringing in 45% of your revenue. The key to developing the courage to take action comes from understanding the hidden impact on the other members of a team that results from allowing the disruptive employee to continue without consequences. By not taking action, a leader is actually condoning the action of that employee and confusing others in the department. Oftentimes, when a leader finally removes that member, the performance of the others increases almost immediately. Having said all this, I want to be clear about one thing. Before you take aim at your top performers, make sure that they are not capable of being turned around. Some people have never been held accountable for being a strong team member and simply need a leader to show them the way. Moving too fast before doing due diligence is not wise. Shooting yourself in the foot to make a point is never a good idea. A team member reports to two different teams. In many matrixed organizations, this poses a difficult problem. The answer lies in the removal of ambiguity and in addressing the situation head-on. For instance, when a team member has responsibility to two teams, the question that must be asked is, which team takes precedence? Because one of them has to be more important than the other. That is not to say that the person can't serve both, but when push comes to shove, and it will at some point, it will be best if everyone knows where that person's primary allegiance falls. There is nothing politically incorrect about this. It is simply a matter of being clear. Now, the people who must ultimately decide which of the two teams wins out in the event of a conflict are the leaders of those teams. Only they, or someone higher in the organization, can make that call. Certainly it should not be the torn team member, although too often that is the unfortunate case.